We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Every morning, we should get up with the attitude, something good is going to happen to me today. In other words, today I could get the contract on the property I'm trying to sell. Today I could see the legal situation turn around. Today I could meet the person of my dreams. Today I could have a breakthrough in my health. 2 Corinthians 6:2 says, now is the time for God's favor. Notice, not next week, not next month, not 20 years from now. No, now is the time God wants to amaze you with his goodness.
That's America's most popular preacher, Joel Osteen. He is also the most successful and most recent manifestation of what is called the American Prosperity Gospel. And he kind of lays it out there in a very soft sell. He's not the first one to do that. He's only the latest. What is the history of the American Prosperity Gospel? Why does it fit so well in America? Although it is easily exportable, why does it fit so well here? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Friday afternoon, May the 13th. Joining us to talk about the history of the American Prosperity Gospel, Dr. Kate Bowler, Assistant Professor of the History of Christianity in North America at Duke Divinity School and author of the book Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. Dr. Bowler, welcome to Issues Etc.
So glad to be here.
Why does the American Prosperity Gospel deserve, as you say, sustained attention?
Well, it's tricky because it's everyone's favorite caricature. It's the first thing people make fun of in a mainline service when they get awkward during a tithing sermon. It's the natural go-to on late-night talk shows to make fun of. So certainly at first glance, it doesn't seem like it's worth serious attention. But if we take seriously the tens of thousands of Americans and then millions globally who look to this gospel as a way to make sense of their health and their finances, I think it asks us to take a second look.
So give us some names today, some current names that our listeners would recognize that are fair representations of what we're going to talk about here, the American Prosperity Gospel.
Well, maybe the best known would be Joel Osteen, the smiling preacher from Texas. Certainly everyone's mom has a Bible study from Joyce Meyer, whose wry expressions and 24-hour programming makes her constantly available to American viewers. And then there's all sorts of international celebrities that everyone else would know. There's the Redeemed Nigerian Church of God, Redeemed Christian Church. I always want to add Nigerian in there because it's a Nigerian denomination. It also depends on how late you stay up at night. If you're watching TV anywhere past 11 p.m., you're going to see a Mike Murdoch or a Paula White. Those might be common names, or a Creflo Dollar or a Frederick Price. It really actually depends, too, where you live, because everybody has a local megachurch celebrity that tends to buy up the airwaves right around them and make sure that they're well-known locally.
Before we get into the history, you mentioned there the megachurch. How would you describe the relationship between the megachurch phenomenon and the American Prosperity Gospel?
Sure. It's kind of tricky because I think it's so easily conflated. We think big churches, Starbucks in the lobby, and then I think we naturally assume that there's a slick preacher asking for money at the helm. But really, there's far more megachurches than there are prosperity megachurches. So what I found in my research was that the reason why we associate megachurches with the prosperity gospel is that the prosperity gospel is incredibly top-heavy, meaning that they tend to dominate the largest churches in the country, so the 10,000-plus category. But in truth, there are probably about 1,600 to 2,000 megachurches total in the United States, and they're everything from, you know, adorable Mennonites to freewheeling Presbyterians to Lutherans to non-denom to prosperity gospel. So it's a wide denominational range. It's just that because the prosperity preachers so frequently are media dominant and buy up radio, television, magazines, et cetera, then people get confused between the two.
Dr. Bowler, let's at least attempt a walk through what you call the long and tangled history of the American prosperity gospel. First, by introducing us to E.W. Kenyon.
Sure. E.W. Kenyon was a late 19th century radical evangelical. And what we mean by that is someone who took seriously the kind of major tenets of evangelicalism, like biblicentrism, crucicentrism. So we like the Bible, we like the cross, we like evangelism. But was very interested in the growing talk of spiritual gifts in the late 19th and early 20th century, something that would gradually crystallize into the Pentecostal movement. And so radical evangelicals is sort of this umbrella term we think of for those pre-Pentecostals as they thought about what their spiritual gifts might do. So he was a radical evangelical who started a Bible school, actually several Bible schools in different locations, and then eventually became a popular preacher in Seattle who wrote some of the major, I guess we could think of as the kind of doctrinal foundation texts of the prosperity gospel. He certainly didn't see himself as much of a prosperity preacher. He never made much money. He didn't really focus too much on the financial aspect, but helped develop a language of faith as a spiritual power that reaches into heaven and draws down miracles. In that time, they were mostly concentrated on achieving the gift of health, which was an overwhelming concern during a time in which traditional medicine was as likely to kill you as to cure you. So E.W. Kenyon uses this language of faith to talk about bringing down miracles for healing and becomes one of the go-to theologians for a growing movement.
You discuss what you call the theology of mind power. What is it?
It's also a way in which I was trying to avoid terms like magic. Mental magic is the term that historians of metaphysical traditions use. But in truth, it's the sense in the late 19th century that the mind was a powerful spiritual force, something that, if cultivated, and they would use language of alignment or sometimes like hydraulic metaphors in which they're talking about kind of combining divine and human flows in order to draw out secret powers. And the secret power was the ability of the mind to create reality if spoken out loud in positive words.
When does this, at least in the prosperity gospel's history, when does it get codified into the form that you mentioned earlier, Joel Osteen, he's popularized this?
Yeah, sure. It's kind of tricky because, in truth, there's different strands. We might think of it as four different strands. American civil religion, which is this endless bootstraps, American dream, individualism, insert endless words like frontier and looking toward the horizon in a determined way. So there's American civil religion, and then Pentecostalism will provide much of the theological infrastructure, plus New Thought, which was that late 19th century theology of mind power. And then we can add any number of other sort of ingredients to create different prosperity gospels before there was something sort of officially known as the prosperity gospel. So, for example, in the first half of the 20th century, we see any number of urban prosperity gospels as people combine ideas about New Thought with various forms of Pentecostalism in northern cities as people are grappling with overwhelming economic inequality and all kinds of health concerns. So we have early preachers like Sweet Daddy Grace, Father Divine, any number of people that if we read their sermons, we might think, this is a lot like the prosperity gospel, but there's no sort of official movement. It's really only after World War II in which all Americans become far more economically confident and are looking for a theology of abundance, that that we have the beginning of what we might think of now as the prosperity gospel, which is traveling Pentecostal tent preachers who combined that theology of mind power in order to preach about God's ability to bring health and wealth to Pentecostals. And since then, it's grown far beyond Pentecostalism, but the kind of early beginnings, what we might think of as the official movement, is really a minority position inside Pentecostalism.
We're talking about the history of the American Prosperity Gospel with Dr. Kate Bowler, author of the book Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. When we come back, what was it about post-war America that made this health, wealth, and happiness theology flower into its full bloom as we see it today? We'll be right back.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Pilgrim Lutheran, Santa Monica, California. Emmanuel Lutheran, Terre Haute, Indiana. Trinity Lutheran, San Angelo, Texas. Trinity Lutheran and Emmanuel Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Schaumburg, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Pipestone, Minnesota. Real Lutheran Fellowship, Rochester, Minnesota. Living Word Lutheran Church, The Woodlands, Texas. St. James Lutheran, Logansport, Indiana. St. John's Lutheran, State Center, Iowa, and Trinity Lutheran, West Chicago, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues, Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues, Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the history of the American Prosperity Gospel with Dr. Kate Bowler, author of the book Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. Folks, Issues, Etc. has been brought to you in part this week by Concordia University of Wisconsin Online. They offer 50 online educational options for you to get your associate's, your bachelor's, or your master's degree. They'll even waive your application fee when you enter the promo code ISSUES. Just click the Concordia University Wisconsin logo at issuesetc.org. Lifelong Lutheran learning, Concordia University Wisconsin Online. Dr. Bowler, what was it about post-war America that allowed this full flowering of health, wealth, and happiness in this theology? Why did it fit so well?
Yeah, and I think we can look at a couple different variables. In the first part of the century, people were largely concerned about health. There was just all kinds of ways in which a long life seemed sometimes unattainable. And so, but after World War II, there's all kinds of vaccines being developed, new medical advances that give Americans far more confidence and in the medical profession in general, but also then they're not turning quite so often to faith healers or other religious figures in order to bring about those miracles, which they can achieve by natural means. So one variable is is likely advances in medical science, which then cause Americans to turn to other kinds of miracles. So instead just of health, they might be looking for wealth or other kinds of, just as you mentioned, well-being. The other is, as I mentioned, that economic flood. For the first time, people are living in these sprawling ranch-style houses in newly cut-out suburbs. They're buying these bonkers huge cars in their parking lot, in their parking lot, otherwise known as a driveway. They have modern conveniences that their parents never would have been able to dream of. And so there is a tremendous sense in which more is possible, and not just possible, but plausible within their lifetime. So there's really a growing confidence. The other religious variables would be that the Pentecostal tent revivalists very quickly become media wizards. So if you think about someone like Oral Roberts, who started out traveling the country, setting up a big canvas tent, inviting tens of thousands of people in across the country, and rolling up his sleeves and getting down in the crowd and healing people, that he then takes that not just on the road, but to the airwaves. And so a lot of these preachers end up being early adopters of technology that make them very powerful gatekeepers in decades to come. So, for example, now most of the major Christian television empires are all run by prosperity preachers who can then vet, who gets to go on television. So I think the increasing prevalence of television allows their message to travel farther and faster than ever before. So it's really a time of tremendous confidence, which really matches the theological mood of the prosperity gospel.
So does that become a kind of a self-perpetuating cycle? That, to take Oral Roberts as an example, tent preacher, radio, then on, I distinctly remember Sunday morning tying my tie as a 14-year-old getting ready to go to church.
Yeah.
And even though we didn't buy into his theology, he was what was on Sunday morning. Something good is going to happen to you this very day, promising a miracle. It becomes, the image then becomes of someone who founds a university and who is wealthy and who, as you said before, gives a hand up to aspiring followers who will then go on and be as prosperous as he is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And in that, there's a certain genius to the prosperity gospel, because it's wonderful at adapting itself to the economic mood. So during that time of confidence, it also tracks the rising cultural respectability of Pentecostals, like an Oral Roberts, who can go from someone who's seen as somewhat of a troublemaker within the denomination to someone who's respected, coveted, asked for his opinion, asked to weigh in. So we can see some of that matching the Pentecostal rise with the economic mood and the confidence they're experiencing. But it also equally does well in bad times. So in the 20s and 30s with folks like Father Divine, it was wonderful during the boom years. And then it was equally adept during the Depression, because it offers people solutions that are free, free thought, free public, free positive speech, free mental realignment. So it will do as well in the 50s and 60s as it will in the late 70s when the economy starts to taper.
Dr. Bowler, I'm wondering, when does it go from theologically, I guess, or psychologically in this movement as it's growing, when does it go from, okay, Christians, it's all right for you to be a good American and aspire to these things, health, wealth, and happiness, to, okay, Christians, this is actually God's will for you, and the Christian life looks like health, wealth, and prosperity?
What a great question. I think you hear a lot of that language as early as the 19th century, in which there's a surge of confidence. But I think you're right that there's a turn not just from hope, but to a mandatory excellence. So there's endless books in my bookshelf I can see right now that say, an enemy called average, in which it's no longer all right for a Christian to be merely mediocre. I think it's possible to track the rise of American affluence in general with an increasing aspiration on the part of religious groups like the Prosperity Gospels to demand more. It would be hard to prove, but we can see it, I think, a bit in their description of what kind of miracles they expect people to have. I mean, some of the early stuff, I'm thinking of A.A. Allen, who was considered very controversial and outlandish as a preacher, was always going for the big reach. I mean, he was the guy who would expect that when he healed an overweight woman that 30 pounds might miraculously drop off, or that people could take their cancers home in a jar is another series of headlines I remember from him. But a lot of the letters to his magazine suggest that what people hoped for early on was really quite modest. One of my favorite headlines is, once too nervous to sew, is now sewing for neighbors. And this adorable article about a lady who just didn't quite have the confidence to sew with her friends. But now she does because of the prosperity gospel. And then compared to Creflo Dollar's recent pitch for a private jet, I wonder if we can see an ever-growing hunger as Americans in general make sense of the inequality between the rich and the poor through demonstrating their own wealth. There's all kinds of reality shows now that show this, in which there's shows on prosperity preacher wives or prosperity preacher families, and what they need to show the American audience to show that they're succeeding is, I mean, it just far outstrips what the preachers of the 50s and the 60s would have asked for.
One of the things that I find fascinating in your research is what you call interpreting failure, how it is that the adherence to the prosperity gospel will generally explain when the mechanism of positive confession or positive words fails to work, or apparently fails to work. What did you discover? What kind of answers did they give for that?
Yeah, there's a variety. I think the most common comes from that agricultural language that Oral Roberts developed about seed faith. So faith propelling your financial gift to the church. It being just like seeds you put into the ground, and there's a kind of germination period, and then you'll see a harvest later. So one of the most common languages of interpreting what I think most people would think of as failure is that of seasons. Well, it's just not your season yet. You just need to wait. There's entire songs, like Juanita Bynum's I Don't Mind Waiting, in which the entire song is predicated on how much she does not mind waiting. I don't mind waiting. I don't mind waiting for you, Lord. But of course, there's only a song like that because people really do mind waiting as they wonder if this is in fact a true failure. And I think that brings us to the second and very common explanation, is that a failure is a result of personal sin. So there's all kinds of books that are just lists of things you should think of when you comb through your biography and wonder if maybe it's that that's caused some kind of blockage between you and your blessing. So unpaid tithes, unforgiveness. It could be anything from a little negative confession, so a little negative word, to yelling at your kids. I mean, there's any number of ways in which we can conjure up our imperfections and worry about them. The third is perhaps more ambivalence. I found that people were much more willing to quietly discuss frustrations with each other than they were to sort of openly disagree with the preacher. So they might just privately say, well, I don't know about what he said, but I'm just not really sure that this is my fault. So there is a kind of ongoing conversation about what constitutes an actual failure. But I think the saddest and the one I saw so frequently was a wholesale belief that it was just their fault, and that there was some spiritual reason why, you know, their cancer didn't go away, or why their child died, or why their house was repossessed. In that, it really heaps condemnation on tragedy quite quickly.
Dr. Kate Bowler is our guest. We're getting a history of the American prosperity gospel. When we come back, the 1980s It was a time of, well, it began with economic recession and then turned into a very prosperous time for America. What did it do for the prosperity gospel? We'll be right back.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
Here's what Chris in Moab, Utah had to say about last summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
I'm a new Lutheran and I live in rural eastern Utah, which is the wilderness for someone like me. There aren't many confessional Lutherans around, so it was a great gift to share a weekend with like-minded people.
You can find out more about the 2016 Making the Case conference Friday, June 10th and Saturday, June 11th in Collinsville, Illinois at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
This is Pastor Donald Jordan welcoming you to Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Chico, California. We stand upon the inspired, inerrant Word of God and preach Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Students at Chico State and Butte College are welcome to our college group. Our divine service is at 10 and Sunday school at 9. We are located at 750 Moss Avenue, and our website is redeemerchico.org.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scare, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Friday afternoon, May the 13th, we are going through the history of the American Prosperity Gospel. Dr. Kate Bowler is our guest. Dr. Bowler, let's talk about the 1980s. It began with an economic recession and then turned into a long period of economic prosperity for the United States. How did it go for the Prosperity Gospel during that time of economic prosperity?
The Prosperity Gospel just loved the 1980s. It was like they were just made for each other. The lapels had become powder blue suits into this wonderful carnival-like atmosphere on television in which the Prosperity Gospel really hit its stride in two ways. One, they had just started founding, for the most part, the first megachurches that would become the center of these media empires. And two, they founded media empires. So if you think about Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, they start not just a church, but a whole theme park in which people can come and participate in a celebratory atmosphere of this God of more than enough. So it's very playful. It's very excitable. It suits the sentimentality and the absurd extravagance that a lot of 1980s, at least Wall Street types, experienced and popularized. If a decade and a theological movement could marry each other, it would be the 1980s and the prosperity gospel.
How do you think, because that was such a powerful force, often the butt of jokes, but here we are 30 years later, and I at least see as an observer, broad observer of American evangelicalism, I see a strong influence of the prosperity gospel finding its way into your average big box non-denominational church that whose preacher may not have any affinity for that theology, but he's starting to sound a lot like Oral Roberts used to sound on Sunday morning.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's a few reasons for it, I think. One is I think we're seeing the Pentecostalization of evangelicalism, not just because most of the most popular worship songs sung in those churches come from Pentecostal bands. So we have, you know, if we think of just how much service time worship music is, that's half the theological message right there. But also just because of media exposure, people have to expect that every woman in their church at least is probably going to see Joyce Meyer when she comes to town. So there's kind of official messages you get from Sundays and then the supplemental spiritual stuff that people are getting and buying throughout the week. And the market is so fully dominated by that message that there's going to be an infusion. But it's also this evangelical narrative arc that always now tilts toward the endlessly positive and celebratory, that it's very difficult sometimes to tell the difference between evangelical positivity and positive confession.
Is this, you had mentioned it has a global reach now, but is this a uniquely American phenomenon? That I mean, are we exporting kind of American prosperity gospel, or is the prosperity gospel finding separate roots in other societies and cultures that isn't just Americanism transferred to some other place?
Yeah, I think it's both, but I think it's generational. So I think in the 70s and 80s, it was that the United States was overwhelmingly an exporter of the prosperity gospel through their theological institutions. So all kinds of people from around the world trained in prosperity gospel Bible colleges or ordered their books on tape series or their pamphlets. So I think that a lot of the educational infrastructure is overwhelmingly American, and that was very successfully exported abroad. So, for example, a little tract by a Tulsa preacher, Kenneth Hagin, El Shaddai, is officially the name of a Filipino Catholic prosperity movement that numbers somewhere between 9 and 11 million. And it was taken explicitly from the Kenneth Hagin pamphlet. So you see those kinds of direct transfers. But as just the words Filipino Catholic prosperity gospel suggests, that it immediately sort of becomes grafted onto other theological, I'm trying to think of the appropriate metaphor that's not just roots but branches, insert agricultural words. I'm not sure. But what you do find is that what was once just a purely American phenomenon very quickly becomes overwhelmingly indigenous. So, for example, the prosperity gospel has done really well in Singapore, this tiny megalopolis that is constantly making sense of their English dominant kids, the specter of capitalism in this tiny island, and it has several very successful, enormous prosperity megachurches with charismatic pastors who now blanket American television airwaves. So we see a return of the prosperity gospel with new faces.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation American civil religion. You call this the alter ego to American prosperity gospel. What do you mean by that?
If you think about the American character, qualities that it so deeply admires, its individualism, its pragmatism, its either natural or desire for supernatural bootstraps, sometimes I play the game, where's the prosperity gospel not? And so the answer is like Northern Sudan. And I would like to say Sweden, but the prosperity gospel was actually very popular in Sweden in the 1980s. But what we find when we try to sort out the character of the prosperity gospel, that it does have an affinity with certain kinds of national cultures. So, for example, I'm Canadian. It did pretty well in Canada, but it's something about the flattening of economic inequality through the deep love of government social services that makes it not quite as able to describe a deeply economically hungry culture. So Canada just doesn't have the culture for entrepreneurialism, for example, that makes the prosperity gospel language thrive. So when you compare, you know, the theology of Donald Trump, for example, with most of the infrastructure of this theological movement, there is so much parallelism that the only fundamental difference is the sense, so instead of just people, every individual fully doing it themselves, they expect that God, through them, will be able to accomplish all things. And in this way, it is such a deeply American gospel.
We have to talk about Joel Osteen. You mentioned him earlier as one of the names that is known, but he's done something different. And
yeah.
I don't know, I have followed him now for decades just as an observer, and comes out of the kind of Pentecostal roots, the word faith movement from his father. But he's tweaked it in a way that no one up to him has done it, and done it well, I mean, for good or for ill, with an amazing success. What has he done that those who have come before him in the American Prosperity Gospel movement, what has he learned, or what does he know about this that has made him so successful?
Well, I think he's a perfect example of how the Prosperity Gospel tried to steer a different course after the scandals of the late 1980s and early 90s, when all of a sudden the American public fell out of love with a crying preacher, a sentimental preacher, that over-the-top parade that had been 1980s televangelism. They wanted something more postmodern, subtler, still positive, but not as slick. Someone very comfortable using psychological language. I feel this. You know, I feel is very different than seven spiritual laws for seven kingdoms, which would be a more of a Mike Murdoch pitch. It became an articulation that I like to call soft prosperity, because it uses the same theological infrastructure, but it comes up with a much more roundabout assessment of that relationship between faith and results. And so someone like Joel Osteen is, I mean, there's certain versions that are quite similar to him. T.D. Jakes, for example, did this quite well. Joyce Meyer is his sort of female analog. But the genius of Joel Osteen is that he takes this very heavy causal language, you do this, you get this result, and he just brightens it up. He's a lot like Billy Graham insofar as he gives the same sermon a million times with few variations, and that's what people like about him. They can expect that when you turn on to Joel Osteen, you'll hear a message of how you, through a certain kind of effort and tapping into God's spiritual principles and believing in God's divine intention for your good and healthy and successful life, can make concrete changes in your life today that will result in a better future for you as soon as next week. I mean, it has this lovely, immediate, very instrumental language of faith. And this is, I mean, you compare him with his dad. He stripped down a lot of the very Pentecostal language. If you think about it, it's almost as if it's everything about Pentecostalism, but that looks good on TV. So everything reads well. It suits, but it's not the heavy Holy Ghost suits of before. It's more like a dapper businessman. He's not trying to be a typical Christian preacher that copies what was cool 10 years ago. He's always trying to anticipate the next thing with music, with the way the church is built and operates, right? It's housed where the Houston Rockets used to play. It's wonderfully culturally and media savvy. And all of this packaging makes the prosperity gospel seem fresh and modern and just like a series of tools that a regular person can use to get ahead in their life without even knowing that it's a very sort of complex theological system.
Well, that raises a question that we'll get to on the other side of the break. I've often wondered, is Joel Osteen a genius, or was he just in the right place at the right time? And, of course, with an already successful church to build upon. We're talking about the history of American prosperity gospel. Dr. Kate Bowler is our guest.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.
You can support the boys' basketball program at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, by entering a team into our annual Golf Scramble fundraiser. It's Saturday, May 28th at Oakbrook Golf Course in Edwardsville. Hi, this is Anthony Smith, head boys' basketball coach at Metro East Lutheran High School. Join me and fellow Knights for a Golf Scramble, May 28th at Oakbrook Golf Course. For more information, send me an email, anthony.smith@melhs.org. Thanks for your support.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Since 1989, the Missouri Synod has allowed men without a divine call or ordination to publicly preach, teach, and administer the sacraments. This will be addressed at the Synod's convention this coming summer. On May 17th, Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy, will be hosting a conference at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, discussing the biblical doctrine of the Holy Ministry and the Lutheran confession of it. All are welcome. Go to gottesdienst.blogspot.com for more information.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org. South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India.
Sweden.
Egypt. France.
Turkey.
Japan.
Australia.
Canada.
United Kingdom.
Hong Kong.
Austria.
Finland.
Malaysia.
Singapore.
Bulgaria.
Korea.
Brazil. You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back. We're talking about the history of the American Prosperity Gospel. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Kate Bowler is Assistant Professor of the History of Christianity in North America at Duke Divinity School, author of the book Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. You know, the Prosperity Gospel promises you the certainty of God's favor in your bank account, in your success at work. For guys like Joel Osteen, even in the best parking spaces. But that's not where the certainty of God's favor is to be found. It's to be found where he proclaims Christ for you in his means of grace, the preaching of law and gospel, baptism, absolution, the Lord's Supper. That's where the certainty of God's grace and favor is found. Chris Roseborough is going to be making a presentation, making the case for the means of grace at the 4th Annual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 10th and Saturday, June 11th in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. Registration for the conference is $100. It includes three meals. You'll find a conference schedule, and you can also register
at issuesetc.org, the 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 10th and 11th in Collinsville, Illinois. Dr. Bowler, coming back to Joel Osteen, I'm very eager to hear what you think about this, and I've wondered about this for a long time. Is Joel Osteen a genius who has engineered this kind of success unlike any of his predecessors really ever saw? Or is he just in the right place at the right time with the TV camera pointed at him and, of course, an already successful church to build upon?
Yeah, I've been writing this article lately about legacy issues in the prosperity gospel because so many people are trying to pass on their little empire to usually their son. And I think it's an open question because the problem is that not everyone gets a Joel Osteen. Normally they get a watered-down version of someone 1,000 times less charismatic and nowhere near the head of hair that Joel Osteen has, who finds himself, and it's almost always the guy, even if the daughter is more charismatic, finds themselves unable to conjure up the enthusiasm that their parents did. So the fact that they've managed to transition from a first generation to a second generation prosperity megachurch and then expand it, I mean, almost tenfold, is really remarkable.
How important, and to kind of segue from Joel to the general conversation again, how important is the image that all, I think that's one common denominator, all of the prosperity preachers and their wives, usually, if they get on camera too, have to present a certain image that is the model, the icon, really, if you will, I mean, in kind of classical Christian terms, the Holy Family, to which everyone aspires. How important is that?
I think the biography of the preacher is incredibly significant. It is the primary example of spiritual principles. So how else can the believer, they would argue, know that if God can do it for them, God can do it for you? And so they become, I mean, every preacher is always mining their lives for theological insight, right? Preachers are cannibals. They're always like that. But prosperity preachers have to be more. They have to be more than just theological grist. They have to be, just as you said, living examples, like living proof that all of these spiritual principles work. So, I mean, I've interviewed people, famous preachers, who get sick and then have no one to tell because they're overwhelmed by what kind of message it would give to their congregation if they were to tell them that they weren't fully living into the health that God promised them. So, yeah, I think the biography of the preacher becomes a new kind of scripture for the congregation, trying to figure out just how these principles work.
Did you learn anything about the refugees from the American prosperity movement? People who leave it burnt out or leave it completely disillusioned?
Yeah, I didn't talk to as many ex-prosperity as I did ongoing prosperity churchgoers whose testimonies I found, you know, usually for their reasons for going to those churches, I found, you know, usually quite lovely and sensible. It is one of the joyful assumptions of cultural history that you get to, that people have good reasons for doing what they're doing. But among those I talked to that had left, there were a variety of some common themes. The first most common, I think, is that they felt like spiritual failures, that through poor health or poverty that they weren't able to give like other people gave, or they weren't able to show that they were healthy like other people were, and that they just couldn't live with the condemnation of being in that kind of environment. So that was quite common. The second is sort of a variation of that, but just the sense that they were sort of failures to fully live into the very totalizing atmosphere of a prosperity church. So prosperity churches are filled with people who want to do better. They want to, I mean, if you see, there's a very kind of didactic atmosphere in those churches. Like they'll have notebooks out and pen and paper ready. This is spiritual school, and they're there to learn how to improve their lives. And so sometimes people just didn't feel like they were able to keep up with the pace of these churches. And so for those people, I heard a lot of like, well, I'll go back later, you know, when I have a little more to give. Another very common complaint was frustration about who was profiting. So just a general sense of disillusionment that perhaps the prosperity preacher was the greatest recipient of the gospel message, and that maybe they didn't need to spend quite so much on that parsonage that cost $1 million, et cetera, et cetera. So there was kind of some growing discontent, depending on which church, because some churches do it better or worse, right? There are prosperity churches in which the finances are absolutely transparent, and every churchgoer knows where the money goes. And then there are ones in which it's incredibly opaque, and churchgoers have to submit their own W-2s and be evaluated on their own finances, but they don't get any of that access to where the church money goes. So it really varies church by church.
If you had to explain this to someone who looks in from the outside on American Christianity, and to them, Joel Osteen or these other people that we have talked about, they're what American evangelicalism really is to one degree or another, and this is really what Christianity is to one degree or another. How would you explain the prosperity gospel movement's place in American Christianity? How would you situate it there?
Well, in some ways, it's a deep Americanization of Pentecostalism, in which Pentecostalism became so comfortable in American culture that it fully expressed all of its hungers and desires for more. In other ways, we might see it, as we've talked about, as another expression of American civil religion, so it's just a kind of de facto sort of almost cultural reflex based on what people see on everything from greeting cards to Oprah. I mean, it's another way of saying everything happens for a reason. Just one of the many kinds of cliches that people trade when they're trying to explain why some seem lucky and some seem unlucky. But I think, as you mentioned about evangelicalism in general, I think we are increasingly seeing this as a kind of amplified evangelicalism, in which this is sort of sanctification language on steroids, in which everyone expects that this ladder to better, and usually typically people mean spiritually better, but better as an all-round prosperity is becoming a very common evangelical language to explain churchgoers' hopes and desires. So I think we can see it kind of at several different angles, but what's I think most interesting about it is that it's actually really hard to see. I mean, it's become so culturally reflexive that that people almost don't know it's religious, right? Like, no one knows what theological tradition, unless you pay very close attention, like that a Joel Osteen or a Joyce Meyer belongs to. It just fades into the landscape as a kind of generic, non-denominational Christianity.
With about 30 seconds, I know you wrote a history, but where do you think it's going?
Oh, I absolutely think it's going to increasingly become an evangelical language of its celebratory optimism, and also our desire to make pastors into celebrities. And so our Hollywood culture is becoming our church culture, in which market rules trump church restrictions. So I think we'll see the market triumph until there's pushback for smaller, fewer Starbucks-laden churches.
Dr. Kate Bowler is Assistant Professor of the History of Christianity in North America at Duke Divinity School, author of the book Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Dr. Bowler.
Thanks so much for having me.
Next week on Issues Etc., we'll look forward to Trinity Sunday with Dr. Carl Fakencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll talk with Dr. Ken Sherb about the Augsburg Confession, and we'll get an update on the November elections from journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway. The greatest danger, the greatest tragedy of the prosperity gospel is that it robs people of the true wealth, the true riches, the riches that are found only in the true grace of God in Jesus Christ, his undeserved favor for us that doesn't depend upon the strength of your faith or upon you speaking a positive confession, but depends entirely upon the perfect life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ for you. That is God's true riches for everyone. That is for those who are weak of faith. That is those who are weak in their works. That is for all sinners. And God gives it all to every single one of them. He's not stingy with that. He doesn't wait for you to act. That grace, that forgiveness is absolutely free because it is in Jesus Christ alone. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
What makes Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois so special? Our new members talk about the family atmosphere, the welcoming people, and the outstanding music. But most importantly, you'll be confronted with your sin and comforted with the assurance that Jesus has removed that sin so that you can live each day as His baptized and forgiven child. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is at 612 North State Street in Freeburg, Illinois. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible classes at 10:20 a.m. Call 618-539-5664.
The Divine Service is where Christians gather around Word and Sacrament. We join together to receive God's gifts in the liturgy. But do you know the meaning behind what we do? There's a book called Ceremony and Celebration that explains Lutheran liturgical worship. Find out more and read book excerpts online at emmanuelpress.us. E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L press.us. You'll find answers to your liturgical questions in Ceremony and Celebration, emmanuelpress.us.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We are what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.